Some of humankind's greatest accomplishments have come since we stopped moving around and started planting our food on purpose. Civilization, by its name. Look what civilization and progress have given us. Great mobility, great comforts, the ability to communicate over long distances, like radio. And then consider the downside. We have lots of cool stuff, but we also have to work long hours to be able to afford it. That's among the observations in Christopher Ryan's new book, Civilized to Death: The Price of Progress. Christopher Ryan is making a return visit to the Exchange. He was here in May 2011 to talk about Sex at Dawn, a book he co-authored that has now been translated into 22 languages. In addition to his writing, Christopher hosts a podcast called Tangentially Speaking, which features conversations with a wide range of guests. So, Christopher Ryan, thank you for sitting on the other end of the microphone today.
It's my pleasure to be here, Jeffrey.
You got us thinking deeply about monogamy in Sex at Dawn. So is similar questioning of some of our basic premises here?
Yeah. Basically, it's the same approach looking at conflicts between the animal that we evolved to be and the context in which we evolved and the modern world and the demands of the modern world and the restrictions placed upon us. Lots of those points of conflict generate trauma, whether in terms of frustrations in relationships or sexual dysfunction, some of the issues we covered in Sex at Dawn, or in Civilized to Death, looking at more broadly at how children are raised, why depression and suicide and anxiety are so prevalent, and loneliness and obesity and heart disease, and so many of the modern ills that we confront are traceable directly to these conflicts between the world we evolved to occupy and the world we actually do occupy.
You set the tone very early in the book, Civilized to Death. Do you think we've reached the end of progress as a concept?
Well, the concept is surprisingly robust despite absence of evidence to support it. If you follow my reasoning there, it's people want to believe in progress because I think we're naturally optimists. We tend to believe things are going to get better. And in order to believe that, we have to believe that things have gotten better. And so there's a lot of psychological resistance to the notion that maybe things actually aren't getting better and haven't been, and that we've been sold a bill of goods concerning progress. You know, the cure for cancer is always right around the corner, but it never seems to get cured. World War I was the war that was going to end all wars. That the sales spiel keeps coming, and it never seems to get old, but the product never arrives.
Do you think that stands in the way, Christopher, of us taking some measures to improve our lives immediately? I mean, like, for example, with climate change, where people are like, yeah, I think it's a real thing, but I think we'll be able to get ourselves out of this technologically. Is that sort of standing in our way?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think the blind faith in technology to solve our problems does impede us in confronting those problems on a deeper, more fundamental level. And it also stops us from really having a clear understanding of the costs of technology and the costs of civilization, as you mentioned in your intro. So often we talk about and we're presented the benefits, which are real, and I'm not denying them. But those benefits come at great cost, often cost that offsets the benefit itself. For example, I'm often, when this comes up at cocktail parties or, you know, whatever, in conversations, people will say to me, well, yeah, but I mean, we have all these vaccines. Modern medicine is miraculous. Just think of all the things people died from, all the diseases that people died from in the past that we've obliterated. And that's true. But what they don't understand, and I don't blame them because people have a very vague sense of human prehistory, most of the great diseases that have killed people, smallpox, influenza, tuberculosis, you can go down the list, none of those diseases existed until civilization. So a great number of the supposed benefits of civilization are partial fixes for problems that were, in fact, created by civilization.
So you make some observations in the book about, for example, the animals that we eat and how we cluster them together. Is that part of the situation with humans, you're saying, that we cluster ourselves too close together?
Well, yeah, we are essentially a self-domesticated animal. And some of the diseases that I mentioned earlier are diseases that came into human experience from domesticated animals. So smallpox, chickenpox, those diseases came over from domesticated birds. Tuberculosis came from cattle. Various forms of influenza came over from pigs. So this, all these diseases, these pathogens adapted to humans when we started living in close proximity to animals. Then you have diseases like cholera and other diseases of sewage that, you know, for centuries we lived in settled villages with no system to remove sewage. So we were literally living in our own waste. And that caused all sorts of death and destruction. So yes, we are domesticated animals. We live in something, in many cases, that looks very similar to the way we raise chickens and pigs and cattle. And we suffer from many of the same anxieties and ailments that they suffer from.
The title for the introduction to your book, Civilized to Death, comes from Dr. Jonas Salk, Know Thy Species. What did he mean and how are you using it?
Well, he made the very important point that in order to know yourself, you need to know your species. You need to understand what sort of animal human beings are. And it's impossible to do medical research, which was his field of expertise, without looking at human beings as biological entities, as animals, which we clearly are. We're one of the five great apes. And so we need to understand what sort of animal we are, and before we can start talking about what sort of world we should inhabit. We're going to inhabit an artificial world. There's no getting around that. There's not enough of the natural world for us to inhabit it. So we need to design that world with an eye toward what sort of animal we are.
You were just saying because we have so many people on the planet, we can't really live in nature as we did. You say you don't harbor illusions about getting back to the garden. So how should we approach our own thinking about the book as we move into it?
Well, I tell the story in the book of a time probably 30 years ago now. I was traveling in Indonesia, and I went to a small city called Bukit Tinggi on the island of Sumatra. And there was a zoo there that I visited, and the zoo was maybe the saddest place I've ever been in my life. It was just a series of concrete cages with rusted iron bars, small prison cells, basically, housing some captured orangutans. And they were miserable, obviously. I remember the eyes as they like reached out through the bars to me, and it seemed to me they were asking for anything, including death. Just get me out of here somehow. This is absolutely horrible. And after that, I was so traumatized, I didn't go to a zoo again until I was researching Sex at Dawn, and someone invited me to visit the San Diego Zoo to observe the bonobos that they have there. And I went to the San Diego Zoo, and I was amazed at how much care the designers of that enclosure had given to the natural environment and behavior of bonobos. They studied how bonobos lived in the wild and tried to replicate that in San Diego. And they did a pretty good job of it. And you could see that the animals were happy. They were okay. They were enjoying life. And it struck me that human beings live in a zoo that we ourselves are designing. We ourselves design the enclosures in which we live. So why not design a San Diego Zoo for ourselves rather than the Bukit Tinggi Zoo? And so that's what I'm trying to get at. We're not going to live in the wild. That we're not going to go back to a hunter-gatherer life, but we can do things in our lives that bring some ancestral wisdom into our modern lives.
All right, but you do talk about societies where people do still live in nature. There's a great story about foragers in the upper Amazon an author who lived with them for 20 years or so. Life is not terribly easy there necessarily, but they laugh all the time, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's the Pinaha, and the man who lived with him was Daniel Everett, who wrote a great book about his time there called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes. And he makes that point that they're very comfortable in their environment. I remember he says something like they laugh when the wind blows a hut over, they laugh when they catch a lot of fish, they laugh when they don't catch any fish. They're just always laughing. And he said it perplexed him for a while because, as you say, their lives aren't easy. And he concluded that the reason they're so relaxed is that whatever challenges they face are familiar. They know that world. That's the same world they grew up in. It's the same world their fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers lived in. So whatever snakes and spiders and weather anomalies and various things that happen, whatever they face, they've faced it before. It's familiar. They know how to respond to it. But so much of the things that we face in our world are totally novel. The internet didn't exist until I was in my 30s. So the world, none of us grew up in the world that we occupy right now. It changes too fast. And so we're always feeling off balance, out of kilter. We don't understand the challenges that we face. We don't understand the diseases and the medical problems that we're facing. It's always new. And that's very stressful. And of course, stress underlies so much of the problematic aspects of modern life, ranging from physiological diseases to anxiety to depression and so on.
Christopher Ryan is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is called Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. But that is a feature as well as a bug, isn't it? I mean, the fact is that we want the new. I mean, in civilization, we always seem to strive for the new. And this narrative of perpetual progress, the NPP, as you call it in the book, is all about the next best thing, isn't it?
It is, but I wonder to what extent that's human nature versus an artificially created appetite. Civilization and capitalism thrive on creating appetite. So much of what we spend our time and money trying to procure is totally unnecessary. And so it's sort of a created addiction in us for consumption and novelty and moving always forward, new, new, new. But when you look at human nature itself outside of the realm of consumerism and the propaganda that we grow up absorbing, you don't see a lot of that. What you see is the things that actually succeed in making people happy. The number one factor in life satisfaction and also in health is whether or not someone feels embedded in a community of caring people. So that matters much more in keeping you alive, keeping you healthy, and keeping you happy than how big your house is or how many houses you have or getting the new car or whatever it is that you're told you want. So I think it's very important to, you know, getting back to the quote earlier, know thy species, to understand what really works for us to make us happy and healthy versus what we're told will work for us. Whose agenda are we serving here? I guess it comes down to whether civilization works for us or we work for civilization.
Huh. Interesting way to put it. So if the thing that makes us happiest is being embedded in a community, in a social structure, how different are the social structures in foraging societies compared with the civilized world?
Well, they're extremely different. I have a friend actually in Portland who's a fireman. And one time we were talking about all the horrible things that he sees on a regular basis when he goes out on calls. And he said to me, you know, the worst thing I see and the thing that I see most often is isolation and loneliness. So many people are living alone in their apartments in the big city, and to the point where they might call 911 just to have someone to talk to. They'll send out a fire truck just to have some interaction with human beings. It's more people live alone today than have ever lived alone in the history of our species. It's about 25% of people in the United States. There was a study I read recently that said something like 50% of the people who responded to the survey said they had no one that they could confide in. So I think this is unnatural. This is not human. And this is a result of this very inferior zoo that we've designed for ourselves. What we need is social interaction. We're the most social species on the planet. Think about what we do. What is the worst punishment we give to a murderer or
solitary confinement?
Exactly. They would rather be mixed in with the population of other killers and thugs than they would to be alone. It's the worst possible punishment, and yet it's a punishment that we mete out to ourselves and each other regularly.
Christopher Ryan, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress, in which we are asked to consider the things we have gained through civilization, but also the things we have given up and the inferior zoo that he thinks we have constructed for ourselves, and he advocates building a better zoo. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. A lot to think about here. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk about the process of civilizing us. This is really interesting, where some researchers say agriculture was an accident or a last resort.
Yeah, it's a lot of people think of civilization as agriculture, which is the precursor to civilization and the necessary element of civilization. Many people present that as this wonderful innovation that some genius came up with, and it probably was, in the initial stages, a great idea that saved a lot of lives. But what happened was it started a ratcheting process from which we have not been able to escape. Because as soon as you start manipulating the environment to create food, a whole set of factors come into play. First of all, population starts to grow dramatically. So if you look at global human population for the last 300,000 years, which is how long we have existed as an anatomically modern human species. So roughly about 300,000 years ago, people who looked like you and me, who had brain capacity equal to ours, bodies like ours, have existed. And so agriculture came about 5 to 10,000 years ago. So we're looking at a very small fraction of the human experience that has been since agriculture. But the point is, addressing your question, agriculture was a response to climate change, to a rapid change in climate. And at the time, it saved lives because there was suddenly less food available until someone figured out that they could dig a trench from the river to the dying fruit trees and keep those fruit trees alive and producing food. And that was the first step in a process that led to rapid population growth, standing armies, political hierarchies, women's loss of status that had been equal to men and suddenly was closer to farm animals. The whole experience of human communities and human life changed radically with the advent of agriculture in ways that were detrimental to almost everybody.
I'm really struck by the idea that it was a particular period in climatic history that produced agriculture. So essentially, climate change changed us.
Exactly.
Sensing irony here.
Yeah. Well, I think the point is that we're in an interactive relationship, right? Where it's a symbiotic relationship. Living things are part of the earth. They're part of the weather. We breathe the oxygen and produce the carbon dioxide. We are integrated into these processes. So to see ourselves as separate from them somehow, or just observing them or sort of reaching out and tweaking them is the wrong way to look at it. We're embedded within them. Agriculture sort of erupted at different times on different parts of the planet independently. So it's not something that just happened once and spread. It happened in Mexico, in South America, in southern China, and of course in the so-called fertile crescent at different times. But we can see now that the same set of circumstances led to the eruption of agriculture in those different places in each case. So it's pretty clear that it was a change in weather patterns, sort of abrupt and severe change that led to agriculture in each case.
So when you get these agricultural societies, these civilizations that run up against the still hunter-gatherer societies, as happened with Christopher Columbus, for example, it's quite a collision. And I'm struck when you relay Columbus's own observations about meeting the people that he met in the Caribbean, and that he admired them. He thought they were pretty and sweet and kind and all that stuff. But as you point out, he made a huge pivot in his narrative.
Yeah, it's chilling to read those letters that he sent back to the King and Queen of Spain. It's maybe the greatest pivot in human history, because he describes them as incredibly generous. If you express admiration for anything they have, they just give it to you freely. They're happy, they're laughing, they're physically beautiful. They live in land with plenty of food and fish and fruit and so on, very rich. In fact, some have argued that the word Indian actually comes from the fact that Columbus said in Spanish in one of his letters, "Seguramente es gente que viven en Dios," which means they are certainly people who live in God, in Dios.
Dios. Mm-hmm.
I don't know how historically accurate that is. I think there's a lot of debate around that. But in any case, just after describing how these people live in paradise and are the sweetest, kindest people in the world, he says, with 50 men, I could subjugate them all.
Wow.
They would make great slaves.
Mm. So he also regarded that as their only use, really, to the people that were encountering them from Europe. You say in the book, Christopher, that civilization fueled his cruelty, but this is making an assumption that no pre-civilized societies committed war upon each other. Is that the case?
Well, there's war, and then there's massive enslavement and extermination. What Columbus and the other Spaniards and later British and French were doing in the Americas was something beyond fighting just over some limited resource. Of course, there's a lot of debate about the extent of war in prehistory. I tend to agree with those who argue that war on a large scale was a result of civilization and didn't pre-exist civilization. And there are many reasons for this. I get into it in the book in some detail. Of course, the archaeological record is scant, and it's up for debate. Different skeletal remains can be interpreted in different ways, whether this hole in the skull was created by an arrow or an animal biting it or just a deterioration over the last 30,000 years. These things are hard to debate. But when you look at modern-day hunter-gatherers, you see very little conflict between most groups outside of Papua New Guinea is a particular example. But in the Amazon, in Africa, the Inuit, in the Arctic, you see very little conflict between groups. And one of the reasons is, well, there are two major reasons. One is that they're dependent upon one another. So you tend to see very strict rules around hospitality, because it's common for one area to have a failure. Maybe the caribou don't run that year, or particular plants don't bloom as much, or the rabbit population is much lower. And so they move into the neighboring areas to survive, and those neighboring groups will share with them in order to allow them to survive. Now, they don't share with them because they're noble savages. They share because they know that their rabbit population can drop, or they might not have the caribou next year. So there's this mutual interdependence that helps groups survive. And there's no accumulated resources to fight over. That's the main point. There's nothing really worth fighting over for foragers.
So the idea that that human life before civilization was nasty, brutish, and short and all that, are we essentially wrong about all three, are you saying, Christopher?
Yeah, that's Thomas Hobbes said that in 1651, and the entire quote is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And as we touched on earlier, life is actually more solitary now than it's ever been for human beings, certainly in small-scale, closely knit, interdependent, egalitarian hunter-gatherer groups, which is how we live for 295,000 years of our 300,000 years as a species, roughly. It's wrong on every count in terms of the brutality and the harshness. Hunter-gatherers work less than most modern people do. Hunter-gatherers work roughly about 20 hours per week. Anthropologists have studied this in great detail. And when we talk about the work that they're doing, it's mainly activities that most of us would consider to be vacation. Hunting, fishing, walking around, right, gathering fruit.
I hadn't thought about it in that context, but yeah, people who go hunting now, it's a day off for them.
Exactly. And these are things that are enjoyable to do. And there's the reason that they're enjoyable, hiking and being in nature. These things are enjoyable because this is the world that we are evolved to occupy. This is our home. There's no mystery that when someone suffering from great anxiety, can't sleep, whatever, what they want to do is get out into the woods. Of course they do. They're going home. Where we live now in cities and suburbs and stress and traffic and, you know, looking at our screens, none of this is home for human beings. This is someplace very far from home.
So you do point out, though, the short part, though, the reason we keep thinking about life as short and life expectancy as having gotten so much longer, you bring up the issue of childhood mortality among foraging societies. That is high, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite high, and this is, this gets back to the point we were talking about earlier where people want to believe in progress. So when you tell people modern medicine has doubled the human lifespan, everybody's very prepared to believe that, despite the fact that it's simply not true. Human beings were never old. Our species, Homo sapiens, has never been old at the age of 35. That's simply not true. Any scientist who has studied this will tell you that. There's no debating this. Now, the reason so many people, including some medical students who I've taught in medical school in Spain, believe this to be true is that it's such an appealing narrative that people don't question it. What's happening is the high infant mortality is being included in the calculation of average longevity at birth. So if 30% of the children die before the age of 10, and you're averaging out how old people are when they die, that's going to skew the numbers down quite a bit, even though old people are in their 70s and 80s.
It seems like science would have taken that into account. I mean, figured out a different way to do the averaging, you know, the mode of the median.
Right. What they should be looking at is average longevity from 10 onward, mm-hmm. right? That would give you a much more accurate understanding of how old people were when they were old in hunter-gatherer groups. But the reason they don't do that, I argue, is simply that it tells a better story. It makes people happier. And there are, you know, every social system is self-congratulatory. Everybody, you go around the world, everybody will tell you that where they live, their country, it's the best. The French believe they're the best. Texans think they're the best. Everybody thinks they're the best. So we have this sort of innate need to celebrate ourselves, and we do that in terms of time as well. Now is the best. Why? Well, because I'm here now, so it must be the best. You know, we don't.
Yeah, I live here, therefore it's a good place.
Exactly. You know, that's that old line about patriotism, right, is believing your country is the best because you happen to have been born in it.
Let's take some phone calls. We have Misha in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Christopher Ryan. His book is Civilized to Death.
It's an interesting conversation. I was reading about Thailand and everything that this guy wrote, this grumpiest guy, the most blitzed Thailand. It's a place with a lot of bliss because people are there for one another. I had a situation before where, I fell in the United States and walked around. There's nobody help me. See, in Thailand, if someone falls, people will happen and they'll help them up. And they say that people to be considered, or someone lives there, says people don't see arrogance around their people. They kind of get along with one another. They're there for one another. Mm-hmm. And like here, I think so many people are like are by themselves. Like people can be around and someone falls down and no one helps them up, and because we don't really have much of a society. We're just kind of, people aren't really there for one another here too much.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Misha. So, Christopher, is there a civilization on Earth you think is getting close to having the good zoo built for themselves?
Yeah, I think that a lot of different cultures approach this in different ways. I think the United States is probably the furthest away because we're so deeply aligned with individualism and capitalism that we live to work where most people work to live. I spend most of my life living in Spain, which is a much more relaxed sort of human approach to life, I think, than the United States. And I don't say this to denigrate the United States. I say this out of compassion. I think most Americans don't understand that life here is much harder and harsher than it needs to be, and that getting more money doesn't make it better. In fact, more money often demonstrably makes it worse. Some of the research that I was most sort of amused by in the book was looking at how wealth makes people less compassionate. As the caller was talking about, someone who falls and people walk right by without helping them. Well, there's a researcher at Berkeley who had an old woman sort of stand at a crosswalk with a cane, and he had set up a video camera. And he would monitor which cars stopped and which cars wouldn't stop to let the woman cross. And as it turned out, the more expensive the car was, the less likely it was to stop. So wealth, and this is just one of a dozen different studies that I look at in Civilized to Death, wealth seems to correlate with a reduction in compassion for your fellow man. So the idea that getting more money is going to make life better, it actually often works the opposite way.
Well, let's take a call here from Brad in Ashland. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Christopher Ryan, the author of Civilized to Death.
I'm so glad to hear you again, Christopher. I've admired your Sex at Dawn book for years now. I don't put it down because other people do when they're reactive about its thesis. But I think that is part of a vision of a potentially better society that we could have. I'd like to put that book's thesis together with the last segment on the Jefferson Exchange, where they had a guest on talking about compostable packaging so that we can put it in our compost and let it rot instead of creating plastic mess for everybody. So if we care about this earth and how we live on it, can we arrive at a more Bonobo-like, San Diego Zoo-like civilization rather than what we've headed towards recently?
All right. Excellent questions. Thanks for that, Brad. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, thank you, Brad. I do think that there's a potential, certainly, and the first step in the potential is, getting back to Jonas Salk, know thy species. And so that's what I'm trying to do with Sex at Dawn and Civilized to Death, is to help people have a more compassionate understanding of what our species is, how we arrived here, what our nature is, and how we're not, we're walking around in the wrong size shoes, essentially. And that's why it hurts. It doesn't hurt because you're a bad person or because you don't have enough money or you've made mistakes. It hurts because the world that you're living in isn't the right world for your species. And, you know, I talk about some of the sort of anger of teenagers. I think a lot of the anger that teenagers experience in the United States particularly is associated with realizing just how out of sync this world is that they're going to be living in. And there's a rebellion against that. As far as creating this better world, I hope that we're at a point, you know, I think about Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces and how every society has the same origin myth, essentially, where someone goes out and explores and has experiences and faces challenges and learns lessons, and then they return back to where they began. They return home with the knowledge that they gained in that life experience. And those two things together, returning home with that knowledge and experience, are what's essential to creating a healthy and happy and sustainable life.
I was going to say, in the realm of Know Thy Species, though, one of the more interesting tales in the book is about a non-human situation where you talk about the nice grasshoppers and the terrible marauding locusts and the fact that they really have something in common.
Like their DNA. Yeah. They're the same animal. Yeah. And this is part of Know Thy Species, right? People say to me, you know, ask me, okay, so what is human nature? Are we peaceful or violent? Are we generous or are we stingy? What, you know, selfish? And I say, well, that's like asking, what is the natural state of H2O? It depends on the context. Our nature is very changeable and adaptable. Just like H2O can be steam, it can be liquid, it can be ice, it can be solid, it can take different forms depending on the situation. And so what we want to do is we want to create social structures and contexts in which our best nature comes forward and flourishes, in which our natural tendency toward compassion, toward you know, interdependence and generosity, where these things are allowed to flow. And that would be intelligent social design, in my opinion.
So when you talk about concrete ways to bring this about, to redesign our zoo, to come back to your metaphor, I mean, do you think about things like guaranteed basic income? Is this one of the things that you think might be a pathway toward that kind of society?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think, you know, that replicates one of the most essential and fundamental elements of hunter-gatherer life, which is egalitarianism. So even if you're not a good hunter or you just don't enjoy hunting, you still get to eat along with everyone else. In fact, laziness, the way we look at it, is both very common and very rare in hunter-gatherers. It's common in the sense that people don't do things unless they're necessary. They generally don't go hunting and gathering until they're out of food and they're hungry. But on the other hand, it's very rare in the sense that everyone wants to contribute. Everyone wants to be involved. And it's seen as a sort of a privilege to be able to give more. It's strange in the sense that so many of the most foundational elements of hunter-gatherer life are expressed in our nature, but are discouraged by the modern world that we live in. Politics, for example. In hunter-gatherers, someone who expresses a desire to be a leader is considered absurd and ridiculous and disqualified from leadership.
And you point out that might be a good thing in today's world, there we are. Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress is the book. Christopher Ryan is the author. He visited a few years ago to talk about sex at dawn. Good to have you back. Thanks so much for the book and the visit.
Thanks for having me on, Jeffrey.
All right, take care.